Hello and welcome to the show. If you're enjoying it and want an ad-free experience, consider signing up for the Patreon, patreon.com/the101podcast. Get early access and exclusive content on there as well for less than the cost of a cup of coffee. Links to ways of supporting the show are in the description. Thank you so much for listening and enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the One-on-One Podcast with your host, Juan Ayala.
Welcome back to another episode of the Juan Podcast. Welcome back, except to all the gematria fags. Don't come back here ever again. But make sure to follow the show on social media, tjojp.com. Make sure to follow me on Twitch, don't be a bitch, at twitch.tv/Juan Podcast live every Tuesday night. Come hang out, it's always a fun time. Patreon.com/the101podcast. Make sure to check out the Occultist Monday, Homunculus Edition, Homunculus Owner's Manual, all that good stuff. Find on the website or the Ko-Fi store, the comic books, all that. And today joining us, once again, the Grifter Master himself, the one and only...
He's a paranoid American.
American, the only guy that I know with a theme song.
I forgot I even had that song, man.
Ranting about conspiracies again, spreading misinformation. Welcome back, dude. What's up?
You know, it's funny you said gematria fags, but did you know gematria fags is 36 in Chaldean? And in ordinal, it's 107. There's so many connections with just you saying that. Lubbock, Texas.
What does it dreams, mean?
Did you know Luciferian in
what
reduction?
Does it mean? What does it mean? Tell me what it means. What are the numbers saying? Oh, the numbers are saying that you're gay. All right. So I woke up this morning and I chose violence because they came at me for trying to de-occult their gay-matria, but who cares about those people? They're lame and they're gay.
Well, I already told you this yesterday before you try and steal credit, but gematria is meth for the occult world. Like, it's a quick hit. It's addictive. You're looking for it everywhere you go constantly. You're asking other people about it. It might not be interested in it. Makes you act a little bit out there. And it's maybe even a fast track on some people for a very schizophrenic lifestyle.
Yeah, definitely schizo. I'm not saying that, right, talismans use magic to... talismans use numbers for magic, so there's something to it. But just because Helene equals, 69 and 19, blah, 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 it equaled 69 too, doesn't mean that it's...
Well, it is crazy something. You're downplaying it because you said gematria fags, which does equal Luciferian and ordinal. So I don't know if you're like intentionally putting these numbers out there and then trying to discredit it to step away from it. If you are, kudos. That's some high level occultism.
There you go, dude. It's whatever you want it to be. You know, if the shoe fits, wear it. If it doesn't, it's probably fake and gay. But plug your stuff, dude, for people. Where can they find you? We're currently working on a project I'm very excited for. I don't know if you want to talk about it.
Are they dropping this already? All right.
I want to, dude. I just think that the concept is so cool that I'm excited for it. But anyways, we're working on a trading card game that is going to... Because people are like, haven't you played trading card games? They're already a cult. Yeah, that's fine. They take a cult concept. But ours is going to be based on actual historical figures. So you'll be able to play... John D. You'll be able to play Fulcanelli. You'll be able to play Rudolph II, or you'll be able to play any occult, Aleister Crowley, all that. We'll probably have a butt plug card or something, and it's going to have mechanics that you can, you're able to battle. You're going to be able to battle Homunculus. Magic the Gathering doesn't let you battle. Well, they probably do, but they don't let you.
So, and I think that's why we're going to have Dog Dixon DMT in the first release. Like, we can't save that for later as an Easter egg. We need to come out of the gate swinging the Dog Dicks.
Dog Dick Nunchucks.
Yeah.
Write that card down, dude. But where can people go to find you, bro?
Well, we were talking Gematria. The best Gematria calculator out there is occultdecode.com. It's got all the different ciphers and free search, and it's better than all the ones you've heard of that actually charge money. So if you just want to dick around a little bit and not get too invested, Occult Decode. Otherwise, ParanoidAmerican.com is where you can find all the stuff. I got something coming out with Donut pretty soon at IlluminatiComic.com. Full breakdown of the Bavarian Illuminati all the way to the hip-hop Illuminati of today.
Nice. Yeah, I actually use Occult Decode quite often to try and find schizo connections that are probably not real. But hey, the Illuminati's creating remote controlled hurricanes. I guess they kind of failed these last two. They had like a little malfunction, so they didn't really hit us. But it is what it is. But we were gonna be talking.
You didn't hear the prayers won. Oh. It came. You didn't. So you've been paying attention because you don't have as much to lose as I do, with a direct hit, right? But people were praying against HARP, and if anything, this last near miss is proof that prayers are at least twice as strong as HARP can be, because it broke that storm right in half, bro. Like, the power of Jesus is way more powerful than power of HARP.
I don't like your tone when you say that, dude. It feels a little bit disingenuous. So, but I'm amen, brother. You know, Jesus is awesome.
Wow. Talk about disingenuous. Yeah, that's cool.
I love Jesus. But what do you got for us today, bro? You mentioned a couple connections, and I don't know. Do you know who Mark Plyer is?
Sounds familiar.
So he's a
comedian?
No, he's a big YouTuber. And a while ago, I've talked about this on the show before, he came up. He starred in this audio drama, which I encourage everyone to check out. All the people that I've showed it to have been just blown away. And it's called The Edge. I believe it's called Edge of Sleep or The Edge of Sleep. And it's about a virus that kills you if you go to sleep. But it's got a whole bunch of like occult lore to it. You know, it's the dream realm. And in one of the main aspects of the whole thing is a whale, which right ties into John D, and then also an elephant, right? This elephant being. And this week they actually dropped the show, The Edge of Sleep. After it was in production, like, I've been waiting for this for like 3 years now when I first heard of The Edge of Sleep. So The Edge of Sleep came out in The Edge of Sleep.
It's a TV show based on an audio podcast?
Yes. Obviously, they changed it up, right? They did change it up quite a bit. So The Edge of Sleep podcast came out in, it was by Q Code, and it came out in, I'll tell you right now.
Did you say this is by Q?
Q Code is when it came out. So it came out,
I see you, Q, out there.
Let's see here. It's 12 episodes. When the hell did it come out? Let's see, y'all. They have a season 2 coming out. But anyways, it came out, when the hell did it come out?
I mean, really, it's always been here if it's related to dreams, right?
2019. It came out in 2019. And like I said, it's phenomenal. Like, it's crazy, crazy good. But you see here the elephant episode number 2, the whale episode number 1, the black triangle. And so now they made the TV show, the Edge of Sleep TV series, which I am on episode 5, I believe, out of 6 episodes. And it is also very great, full of super occult lore. But Mark Plyer is a famous YouTuber. He's got 37 million followers, And he's been in a couple of movies, right? He's like an actor. He's one of these kind of guys. So I think he was... Was he part of Smosh?
I don't know what that is either, man. I'm not... You're in all this.
Smosh. It's like...
What does Smosh stand for?
Smosh was like a... Like this YouTube group that would make like funny videos. I never watched any of them, but I know
kids these days and they're influencers.
Yeah, whatever. Who cares? Anyways, Mark Plyer, I think he's hilarious, and he's a pretty decent actor. So The Edge of Sleep, and when you mentioned the elephants and talking to elephants, I was like, the gematria never lies, because elephant equals 36
in... No way. Which is exactly the same as gematria fags, by the way.
Is it, though?
So what's going on here, man?
Dude, the numbers never lie, brother. The numbers never lie. But, wow, that's funny right there, dude.
See, it was meant to be. And you're making fun of it, and here it is. Proving to you unequivocally that it's legit.
Yeah, but I still don't know what it means, Thomas. So, anyways, we're here, and you're queer. So let's get to it, bro. What do you got about this one guy? You told me about a book that you've been reading. We're going to talk about pygmies, giants, and talking elephants. I think that'll be the name of the episode.
It was a book that I was looking into because we were looking at weird like Mormon claims and like Mormon explorers for another show I do with Heidi Love from Unfiltered Rise. But the book name is called Pygmies and Dream Giants, which I'm already sold immediately because it's also touted as a nonfiction reference book. It's not a fictional book. And the guy's name was Kilton Riggs Stewart. And he's basically... born and raised devout Mormon, raised in Salt Lake City, 1903, goes to school as a Mormon his entire life, but then he starts asking questions of the Mormon church and doesn't really like the types of answers that he's getting, and he starts to become disillusioned, and he decides he's going to travel throughout the rest of the world. Now, this is the exoteric story.
Sorry, look it up.
Pygmies and Dream Giants.
And also, the dream people are part of the Edge of Sleep, pygmies.
And I'll explain how the elephants come up into this, too. So the elephants is because Stewart has never really experienced the outside world yet. He wants to, and he wants to go exploring. So he links up, and he stays with this guy called H.D. Pat Noon. And Pat Noon, he's made a name for himself because he claims that he can communicate directly with elephants using their own native language. And he accepts Stewart Riggs, right? He accepts him to come in and hang out and like learn from him a little bit. Let him ask all these questions. Stay with him and his wife. There might have been an Ed Kelly John D thing going on. It's not clear, but they did have a falling out at a certain point. I think also the wife just maybe didn't even like him. But so he sits here and he lives with him for about 6 months, 1935 to 1936. Teaches him everything he knows, not just about talking with elephants, but about this tribe from Malaysia / the Philippines called the Sinoy tribe. And Riggs Stewart basically gets everything he knows about the world, at least outside of Mormonism in Salt Lake, from this guy just telling him stories for 6 months as he's living with them. So this kind of like forks a little bit where some people claim that the guy Noon that he was talking to that said that he could talk to elephants in their native language was just kind of a shyster himself. Like he was just making stuff up to kind of sound cool. And then that Stewart listening to this, he basically takes this information that Noon tells him. And it's kind of like, I made this. Now he's purporting to be the one that can talk to elephants and that he's done all this research of the Sinoy people. So part of the criticism in the background of the book that I could find is that it's basically written by a guy that heard a story from a guy, and they both just claim to know all this stuff. But regardless, he ends up actually going to these tribes and living with them for a while. And his whole thing is that he's got this impression that they've never been introduced to dream analysis. They don't know about Jungian archetypes. They don't know about psychoanalysis, any of these modern developments in the Western world, right? Because again, this guy's born in early 1900s. It's now 1930s. So this is sort of the dawn of modern Western psychology. So he wants to go and talk to actual pygmies and interpret their dreams and see if he can find any interesting patterns or any connections that would kind of prove that even though they've been isolated, that they might share some of the same dreams as, you know, normal people, I guess, in quotes.
That's kind of racist, but...
Well, no, I mean, the whole entire premise of this whole expedition was very racist.
Isn't pygmies like a racist term now? I don't think you can say that, right?
I can. My family comes from pygmies. I got pygmy blood in me right now.
So I can say this. All right, so this guy, here's the thing, dude. And I don't know if I'm being a little bit too critical when it comes to this sort of thing, but I feel like anyone who is part of the Mormon religion is a little bit more susceptible. I mean, you can say that about any religion, but Mormonism is in specific because it's kind of like a cult. But who am I to say that? I mean, what's the difference between a cult and a modern-day religion?
I think if anything, Mormonism is the most freshest, most modern take on religion that we've got right now. A lot of people are like, oh, Islam's the youngest. Nah, bro. I'm like, Mormonism is way younger than Islam. And Mormonism, they get to change up their rules every year. They don't have all these biblical canons and papal decrees where someone's like, I think this. And they're like, actually, a pope, you know, 800 years ago already figured this out, so you don't got to worry your little brain about it.
Yeah.
Mormon church, every year they're like, man, this doesn't make sense. All right, we're getting rid of the underpants, we're bringing back the hat. And then the next year they're like, all right, we're getting rid of the hat, we're bringing back the toad. It's like this, I don't know, I think that there's something modern to it that makes it more relatable than any of these crustier older religions.
Okay, you make a valid point with that. I get, because so
and whatever form of Christianity has goetic magic and Freemasonry built into it.
Well, it's Freemasonry for the whole family. So Mormonism was established, founded April 6, 1830. So if you add the 6 plus 1830, you get 1836. And I think that, if I'm not mistaken, if you take the 18 and then you multiply it by 2, it's also 36.
Yep, Gematria facts all the way down.
So yes, exactly. It's gematria all the way down, and it's all making a lot of sense, bro. Like when you're coming on here, you're blowing my mind. Elephants is 36. If you do the math correct, you have to do the math correctly. You know, Mormonism was founded on 36. Essentially, is what it really is. Or you just have to do the math the right way to be able to extract that truth with a capital T. So. What were this guy's findings? So he was trying to go and decipher and collect dreams of the pygmies. Was he successful? Because if the pygmies would essentially have the same dreams as, say, somebody who was civilized in the United States or anywhere else, that would kind of prove the idea of archetypes. No, I mean, that would be the whole thing, like the theory of forms. And it would prove Plato, along with a whole bunch of other people throughout history, correct. What did this guy find?
Well, prove is a strong word because there's also a very non-philosophical explanation of this outside the scope of this book. But, I mean, we all share the same organ called the human brain, and it basically is made of the same chemicals and has the same structure in every person. So that's another sort of secular explanation for why people might share the same dreams is because we're literally all using the same hardware. So your question was, what were his findings? Well, he kind of skips to the end in the beginning of his book, and he explains that he's got a combination of white savior complex, but also this like white man's guilt. Like he actually feels that he might have been personally responsible for all sorts of horrible things that even happened in the pygmies' past, which might not make sense. But here's the quote. This is the quote that's at the beginning of the book. It says, maybe it was wrong to study people and their gods, to observe and record their dreams, their magic, and their ceremonies. Perhaps observing the headhunters made me guilty of all the murders they committed. Perhaps the Negrito god, Talandian, whose secrets I learned, was holding me responsible for all of the incest and blood feuds which had gone unavenged since the beginning of time. Or perhaps I already sinned before that fateful evening a year earlier when I visited the Hartendorps and my expedition had its inception. These are the people that he stayed with. Perhaps Mrs. Hartendorp had realized I was already lost. Because remember, I mentioned that like she was already beefing with him a little bit. Perhaps she'd been looking through my skin at some diabolical state of inner stagnation or damnation when she insisted on learning what I was running away from. And this is a reference that when he first starts living for the 6 months with this guy and his wife, the wife was kind of like, why are you so eager to go out and explore like these people that you got no idea anything about them? And she straight up is like, what are you running from? Like she's psychoanalyzing him a little bit and criticizing him because he's this young 20, like early 30 something year old kid that, again, had never really left Mormonism or Salt Lake. And now he's like, bring me to the deepest, you know, jungles of the Philippines and just embed me with tribes. I want to learn everything I can, which seems like an extreme to go from one to the other.
So, wait a minute, bro. This book was written when?
1947?
I have 1954 here. No, so never mind.
Okay, well, I mean, he starts writing it as he's forming this. So yeah, maybe it was early 1950s when it actually got published. And it's based on expeditions that he did in the late 30s and early 40s. So this is a culmination of two decades of actual exploration, not just some dude writing a book about something.
Okay, no, because I found here something. I looked this guy up, Kilton Stewart, and then I guess I saw this quick excerpt. It says, in her version, Kilton Stewart was an anthropologist who visited the Sonoy in the 1950s, yep, rather than a psychologist who visited them in the 1930s. Rather, he is credited with being an anthropologist or a psychologist. Kilton Stewart's very name seems to command unquestioning respect.
Well, that's what I was saying. That Noon guy that said that he could talk to elephants and knew about the Sonoy. So Stewart reads his work and basically just says, I did that. And then he goes to the same region and he acts like he's building on top of what that guy did without necessarily giving him the credit, so that now it seems like Rig Stewart is the authority. He's this well-explored guy, but really he didn't know anything about them. He got it all from this book, and the book was ultimately written by a guy that was convinced that he could talk to elephants in their native language, another sort of British, you know, explorer. So take however much credit you want, but if someone's like, hey, I can talk to elephants in a native language, by the way, I wrote a book, you just read that guy's book and take it for canon and then write your own book on top of that book. There's a lot of faith going around.
Yikes. Well, Kilton Stewart equals 47. We know that, you know, the 47th proposition. So he was probably controlled opposition to begin with. And no, that's interesting. So I thought there was like a fictional type of thing going on, but now I've clicked. So
no, this is real. And he states in the book what his original goal was, and it shifts. He ends up like marrying a tribal girl and like causing, like when he says incest and blood feuds, like he actually caused some blood feuds just by his presence because he couldn't resist the temptation. But so his initial reason for going out there, he says, I hope to explore my favorite psychological theory that all men develop from a single mental pattern and that this pattern can be discovered by a psychological study of successive levels of humans ranging from the primitive to the sophisticate. So this is him saying that the reason that he wanted to talk to the Sonoy and the Pygmies is in his mind, they were the most primitive example of people. They're like the closest to the pre-Darwinian evolution of mankind. They were the closest to like Neanderthals, I guess.
Does that make them closer to God though? Like by being that, because it seems, dude, and I was thinking about this yesterday. So I'm working on a presentation on Homunculus, the movie, and I read the manga and it's all about trepanation, right? And trepanation is essentially drilling a hole in your skull. I'm going to be talking about all that. But one of the main ideas behind trepanation is that since babies are born with, you know, their skull separated, that babies are at a higher level of consciousness because their brains can breathe and they have more oxygen available to them. And during the evolution of man when he stood upright, that less blood was in the brain, therefore kind of dumbing us down. But if you think about this, right, if you have guys that are drilling holes in their head to achieve a level of enlightenment, and they're talking about babies and how they're the most enlightened entities, but really, babies are kind of retarded, right?
Kind of.
So, right, taking all the gematria and all the other garbage into account, does that mean the more you learn, the more retarded you are because you're more enlightened? Because you seem to get stupider with the more shit that you know. You get what I'm getting at, bro?
Well, are we talking white babies?
Oh, well.
Because in the case of Rig Stewart, right, he would argue that a pygmy baby would be dumber than a white baby, even if one of them was enlightened. But I think a better analogy is almost like computers. Like, you go out and buy a brand new computer. Yeah, it's fast as hell for like that first few months, right? But mm-hmm. It doesn't do a whole lot because you haven't installed Adobe Suite and you haven't installed all your games and all your drivers and all the things that make it more complex. And then after you add all that stuff, well, now it's not so damn fast anymore. Like, it's still the same computer, but I almost think maybe babies are that. Like, a baby is like the fresh computer. You just brought it home. It doesn't even have Firefox installed or, you know, anything. It's just got like the basics. So yeah, it's fast, but it can only do so much. But then the more you're able to do stuff, that all weighs you down. And I guess it's more like a Rosicrucian aspect where the baby is the first form of this material forming around like the spirit, right? And then over time you become like withered and like you get scarred and crusted a little bit, but it doesn't mean that you're necessarily more conscious. You're just closer connected to original state as a baby. You can't do anything with it because you're an idiot.
And retarded baby equals 33, so that means that
Freemasons.
That they're, hold on, I got the wrong button here. Let me hit the
Illuminati confirmed.
There you go. So again, that's not me talking. That's what the numbers are saying. So I'm just here to listen to the numbers and what the numbers say. So don't shoot the messenger. Okay.
That would be fire if you were in like a rap battle or like just like a Yo Mama insult battle and all you did was just drop like, oh, that's funny. The word you just said actually means like everything was just a gematria clapback.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't do such a stupid thing, but
no, definitely not.
But it makes sense, right? That this whole concept of being closer to God. So I know it's kind of demeaning, but the idea that pygmies are like the first, and where does the concept, I don't know if you've experienced this or if it's just me, but I've always thought of pygmies as like little dwarves, like small little people.
Yeah.
Is it because of their stature? Because they're smaller in stature than regular people?
I believe so. Although the term gets shifted around a little bit too, to just mean, for him, it was Negritos. That was the other term for these pygmies. And specifically where Rig Stewart talks about, he defines them. He says, Negrito pygmies were the ones that lived by hunting and gathering fruits and nuts, who did not settle anywhere, even to sow crops, the most primitive people still available for study. So that was his definition of pygmy, which might have shifted around since the 1930s and the 2020s.
Pygmies are ethnic groups with an average height of less than 150 centimeters or 4'11" for adult men. So, and in the U.S., that would be considered a
little person,
a midget.
Yeah. Damn.
Can you say that?
Oh, what's the gematria say?
Oh, good question.
Midget versus little person. and specifically, it's Africa, New Guinea, Philippines, and Malaysia. And he decides to go closer to the Philippine Malaysia area.
So the numbers aren't saying anything right now. They're not. It doesn't.
You're not high enough level to see it. That's cool.
It doesn't, fall in line with what I'm thinking. So I'm just not even going to bring up what the numbers are saying right now.
And then here's kind of like the woo woo part of where Rig Stewart even got his start in wanting to go explore. This is how he did, and he calls it the egg story. And he says, I love the egg story. It thrills me even after so many tellings. After all, it describes my discovery of what to me is the mystery of life, the key to understanding man's evolution, man's health, and man's happiness. And he talks about this science experiment that he had to do when he was in school, Mormon school, I'm assuming here.
Of course.
So they take a frog's egg in a biology class. Dr. Child, I don't know what the God Matry says about that, great biologist, discovers that the moment of fertilization, an electric whirlwind is established inside the egg. This whirlwind, an axial gradient, as he called it, maintains a positive head area at the point where the sperm made contact with the egg and a negative area across from it to balance that off. It had the appearance of a tiny trinity in unity with a positive, negative, and central area. I always heard God was the universe with such a trinity. So this is him actually looking at a frog's egg under a microscope being sort of fertilized, and he claims that he can see this holy trinity created in like this electrical storm. I've never heard this before, but he's claiming that this is like the whole thing that made him get interested in human evolution and all this research. So he has this question, and she asks him, this is the chick that's like poking out him, like, what are you running from? And he says, you looked into the egg and there was yourself. Have you been running ever since? That's what she drops on him. And he never can drop this, this line she said to him. Like, he got so shook from her asking it in this way. Like, oh, so you looked in an egg and you saw yourself and now you're running away. Like, what are you running away from?
And it makes sense that, right, because one of the big things in Crowley's life was the egg, right? The egg, alchemy, Michael Meyer. One of my favorite plates is this one here, piercing the alchemical egg with the fiery sword. And maybe we should write some of these names down for some potential card ideas, right? The fiery sword or the alchemical egg, or maybe we can make this one like whole action, piercing the egg with the fiery sword. I like that. So, you know, there's always been this concept. I think it was either Iowas or Land that told him to go find the egg. And if I'm not mistaken, there are writings of Crowley looking for this egg. And now you have this guy talking about an egg. And he said that thunderstorms could what?
An electrical whirlwind, he says, formed this trinity where you've got a positive area where the sperm's connecting with the egg. So there's like actual things happening. And then across from that on the other side of the egg is nothing, like a vacuum of space almost in this microcosm. And then you've got the mass of the egg itself in the middle. And he is stretching this to mean a holy trinity. But it gets even crazier. It gets crazier because he swears that he starts seeing things as he's looking at this. So he says the scientist turned out to be the villain when in the laboratory directed a beam of light into the egg. The inner center that was directing its growth lost control, and a second head was seen to form where the light was focused, resulting in a monster. Looking back, it seemed I never forgot my first love, but from then on, I felt more at home with the monster as though it had joined the brotherhood of human beings. The scientists had introduced a growing thing, an artificial energy pattern, which was strong enough to change its natural inner arrangement. All human beings are subject to recurrent artificial patterns like words, numbers, machines, and ceremonies. And I explained that like the frog's egg, we are all changed by these patterns into super animals or sickly monsters. So the way I read this was that someone shined a light into the egg and he sees a monster head poke out of it, and he's thinking that the act of shining the light introduced energy in an artificial way, like this artificial flashlight, and that somehow created this, I'll say, homunculus of some kind. Like, it added extra energy, an external source of energy, which transformed the egg.
Yeah, that's one of the things that, let me find here. So the beam of light paintings, I think it's Child and Madonna. Let me look it up. Child and
Madonna. And he kept using this egg analogy for everything in life. He started basically saying that even a human being from birth to death, they're kind of in this egg, that you're always being affected by these outside sources, and you're forced to grow and basically eat from like whatever is in your direct surroundings in this egg. So if something corrupts that, you're also getting corrupted because forces beyond your control.
And the homunculus would play into this because I recently did an episode on Joel Thomas's show where Jesus the homunculus, and one of the main motifs that I stumbled across when I was looking at all the miraculous births throughout history was that a lot of these artificial messiahs, as I like to call them, or homunculus, right? Because a homunculus can't, you can use it to acquire godlike powers, right? Or it itself is magic because it comes from the great work or the art. So it's like a divine entity, right? It's a liminal creature, if you will. And one of the reoccurring motifs was that a lot of these messiahs, Zoroaster, or like any of these messiahs throughout Buddha, like a lot of these guys, they were birthed through, including Jesus, right? Because the light of the angel, whatever, you know, and there's paintings of this. I can't find any right now, but there's paintings. There's plenty of them. Is a beam of light. And that's what, you know, usually that's what impregnated the mother of this messiah figure, or this, you know, this figure, head figure.
Sometimes depicted as a dove, too.
Yes.
There's some instances when Mary bangs a bird.
And I don't know if you said it or not, is this a dream that he had?
No, this is something that he claims he saw for his own self in biology class, that a teacher shined this light, and he doesn't say that anyone else saw it. So it almost seems to me that this is like him doing some self-exploration, like some shadow work, where he sees probably just a shadow. I'm guessing he saw the shadow and then was like, damn, that shadow kind of looked like this monster head. And then he starts getting all philosophical about it. So I don't really read this and then be like, oh, this is literally, like, he literally saw a monster with a second head. I kind of get, because he's going to these unsophisticated pygmies to do psychoanalysis on them. So I read this book in the context of someone that's like psychoanalyzing themselves and everyone around them constantly, especially with how much he honed in on that lady that was like, what are you running away from? Like, you wouldn't hone in on that certain phrase unless you were just like, damn, she cut right to me, you know, like that was so Jungian of her.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the paintings, but yeah, it's the ultimate source of, trust me, bro. I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, hey, I did see this, and it kind of makes sense. I mean, right, the egg, we all do come essentially from an egg. I know he was talking about a frog egg and being fertilized, but, and then, you know, little tadpoles do look like sperm, but you know, I look at my kids sometimes and I go, man, you're so cute. You were in my balls, you know, at one point in time. So you were a little tadpole at one point in time. And then through, right, the process of creating a child, we know that the egg is fertilized and we come forth from that. So again, just an observation.
If it's ever like, I'm not going to do my homework, or I'm not going to clean my room, listen, or any of that,
you were, yeah, in my sack. You understand what that means?
There's no coming back from that. You came from my balls.
And he's so enlightened, right? Because he's a baby. He's so enlightened. You know, the effect that has on him. So, it's all clicking.
Well, and they say that, like, that initial skin-to-skin contact when, like the baby's born, to immediately get it on your chest to form that bonding. But what we don't do anymore in this crazy colonized world is they used to teabag your, like, you would teabag your son to, what, transfer that. And I don't know if you've ever heard about the,
really?
The double soul shaman, but he's got this theory that's like the mycelium, but he calls it the testiculum, and that all men's testicles connect to each other through this global network, unless you prevent them from connecting. And then you basically are getting disconnected from this global, like, telepathic network, but it's just telepathic with balls, not brains.
Have you ever looked at the Wikipedia page for teabagging?
I assume that there's something interesting enough to bring it up.
Yeah. I'm trying to see. So you're saying that teabagging was a sort of like initiation?
Well, the same way that you would hold, like a mother will hold the child, or a father will hold them naked against their skin, right? This is just another version of that.
Seems a bit Bach Saga-y to me. I don't know if I'd participate in that one.
Well, and that's why the world's going to hell.
Yeah, that's right. And we're in the dark times, the fall. Oh,
so Rig Stewart also has some pretty groundbreaking theories on all this. He's not just going out there to like see what primitive people think, in his words, not mine. But he also has this idea that in this analogy of the egg, where something could just be shining artificial light on your eggshell and you can't do anything about it, you got to process it, that you've got two chances to deal with that artificial external stimuli. Either when you're awake, or if you can't do anything about it while you're awake, in your dream state. And then he describes that the dream state is the most important, and that your dream visions are the most important things that you can go through, because it's your last chance. He says, this is his word, he says, fate gives us a second chance to adjust, digest those patterns which we could not assimilate properly when awake. So he's almost saying that it's almost like subliminal messaging, but in all forms, like negative energy and people thinking bad thoughts or just walking through a weird radiation field, that in your dream state is your body's last chance to try and like process all of these things. And if you don't, I almost read it as like a Friday the 13th, or like Nightmare on Elm Street rather, where like you got to go be a dream warrior, you got to go defeat Freddy, and if not, kind of Freddy slowly wins over time.
Have you seen Dream Scenario yet with Nick Cage?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Right, it's almost like when they start, you know, spoiler alert, when they start advertising in dreams of the people, and like there's like a whole team of people who are in charge of going into people's dreams to advertise to them specific products. But what are your thoughts on, because this is a reoccurring theme, and I've talked about this for like the last few episodes. One of the last episodes I did was with Ashley Batico, where she talked about reading Robert Monroe's book on the journeys out of the body, which I finished recently, and that when she did that, she actually met Robert Monroe in the astral realm essentially, and was able to see him there. And it kind of reminded me of my favorite episode of all time, the Voyage to a World of Cartesius, where it was like, hey, you know, Descartes had figured out a way to project your consciousness into these other worlds to then go and learn directly from all these the greatest minds of all time, right? And they're like on these other planets, and you were able to go there. But what are your thoughts on the concept of using the dreams to influence reality? Do you think that there's anything to that? Because a lot of people will discredit dreams just right off the bat, like, oh, it's just your brain unloading information, right? We're talking about little babies not having that bloatware. Well, once you're initiated into the world of grown-ups, if you will, you have all this bloatware of like, hey, did you send that email? You got to work your 9-to-5. You got to make sure you pay.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
Just want to remind everyone, make sure to check out the show on Patreon, patreon.com/the101podcast. I constantly get emails, oh, only one episode a week. Yeah, one episode a week for the public, but for as little as $5 a month, you can get up to 2, sometimes 3, sometimes 1 episode per day on the Patreon, as well as on the YouTube channel as a member for as little as $5. And there's also on the Patreon over 250 episodes only found on there. There's an extensive backlog of episodes. So check that out. For those interested, for those asking, make sure to follow the show on YouTube, Juan Juan Podcast. Also, Juan Juan Media. I am going live every Tuesday on there streaming. I also go live on twitch.tv/JuanOnJuanPodcast. So make sure to check me out on there Tuesdays, 6 p.m. Eastern. And make sure to get your copy of the Occultus Mundi Homunculus Owner's Manual, all that good stuff at tjojp.com. You can pick up your copies there or go over to the Ko-Fi. I'm on Facebook, Twitch, Kick, Rumble, all that good stuff. You know where to find it. And enjoy this episode. For mortgage, you got to make sure you pay your car insurance. You got to make sure to go to your doctor's. Once you have all that, your brain kind of freaks out. And it's just like, here, let me unload and do a disc cleanup, you know, when I'm offline. And that's all you're seeing. You know, that's what dreams are.
Or do you think start having dreams about paying off your insurance?
What does that mean? What hold on, let's see here. What are the numbers saying? Insurance.
I think that clearly if you can have control or understanding over your own dreams, then that can have tangible effects in your life. But if you're getting to the extremes of Eleven and Stranger Things, where she can astral project and like cause something else to happen elsewhere, or even in the Voyage to Cartesius, they mention this idea that you can leave your body and someone can give you a physical item, but if you try and go back home and fly through a window or a wall, then you'll cause damage and the thing gets like stuck on the wall, which almost seems to imply that if you were to astral project and, you know, like Socrates gave you a quarter or something, then as you're flying back home, you could drop it on someone's car and like ding their windshield, right? Like in a mundane way. But that, to me, that's an extreme that, I don't know, that's some trust me, bro area. But I think that personally, yeah, there's definitely unequivocal evidence that dreams can destroy you, or they can help improve you, or you can just ignore them and have no benefit from them at all.
So you don't buy into like the whole CIA gateway experience where they were trying to essentially weaponize?
I believe they were trying to. I don't know. And maybe it is possible. I wouldn't discount any of that. But I'm such a capitalist that I really believe that if it were possible, someone would be selling it as a service. You'd be getting blasted on Instagram. Like, would you like to put dreams in your competitors? You're like, would you like to advertise directly in dreams? I feel like that would just be a service offered. But I don't know. Maybe they are keeping it under wraps.
Illuminati confirmed.
So the right, because there's a difference between, because a lot of these conspiracies that you get is if there's a study, for example, of like weather modification, right? It was a big one right now, or XYZ. It's like, well, the government attempted to steer hurricanes, but do we actually know if they ever succeeded? Right. So how you're saying there was an attempt to weaponize dreams. They say that they dropped it because they couldn't find anything with it. Are they telling the truth? Are they
another maybe strained analogy here? I don't know if you've ever been to a rodeo. I'm sure you have. You're kind of rednecky. So when they let the bull out of the pen, right? They're working the bull up. They're like slapping it, like they force it into this confined area where it only has one way to get out, and it starts getting pissed. Like, and they're not going to just let it out if it's docile, right? Like, they want it to get all worked up. So in my mind, people that are like, the government created the hurricane, or they're using HAARP to turn the hurricane this way, the same way that guy slapping that bull on the ass like created the bull, like, sure, but the bull existed. The bull already has its own trajectory, its own things. And I do believe that the government slaps that hurricane on the ass every once in a while. They're like, let's just beam some energy up in this thing and see what happens. And maybe they do see it like, oh, it turned a little bit to the left. Okay. But they're not going to tell anyone in case something bad happens. But also, it's not like you've got some simulation that's that you would trust to be like, and this is what would happen if we pointed HAARP at a hurricane. Like, you would actually want to do the real thing on a real hurricane. And it's already such a chaotic moment. And if they've got a technology that surpasses what anyone else has to detect it, why not? That is the entire MO of the government and military and CIA and everyone, is to be like, hey, we've got to jump on this. Let's just see what happens if we throw like a little bit of salt into the pot. That's kind of what their MO is. I don't think the CIA or HAARP or any of these guys have ever sat down and they're like, all right, how do we create a hurricane from scratch? I don't think it works like that.
Or
like, you wouldn't raise your own bull for the rodeo. You know what I mean? You wouldn't raise it from a little baby.
And, or in the case of the Milton, they sprinkled the dead dude's ashes into the hurricane right before it hit landfall. But I'm in that camp of what you're saying, that maybe they think that they themselves have made a difference, right? By beaming HAARP into it. And little did they know that they actually turned the hurricane a little gayer. Yeah. With the energy beams being.
It honestly, dude, it turned into a top, right? Because the whole bottom fell off of that thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. Right there. Because they're penetrating it with the radar. So it makes a lot of sense, dude.
They injected way too much, I guess, masculine energy into the hurricane, and it became a straight top instead of a top and a bottom.
Anyways, listen, dude. So we have this guy trying to analyze these dreams, and he talks about his egg experience. Where do the dream giants come into play with this? Because I want to talk about the dream giants and the talking elephants, too, while we're at it.
Okay, so he gets embedded in these Negritos. He sort of just calls them Negritos. That's like,
but you know what that means, right?
Pygmies, the little blackies, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's kind of racist. Yeah.
Come on, we're not allowed to define where. So he says Negritos in the Bataan Peninsula, northern along the Zambales Mountains, and then there was also another community they had direct contact with called the Kalingas, the Kankane, and the Bantos.
Which is this right here. This map, right?
Good.
Which is this map that we're seeing here.
Yeah, he's showing you this whole entire area. And then he also mentions a group called the Ifugao. And here's how he describes the different ones. But he says that the Kankane do not take heads. And the Bontocs are friendly to Americans, so you can relax while you're in their territory. So he decides that, okay, those are the ones that I'm going to end up embedding myself in, the ones that maybe won't take my head and shrink it. So here we go. He says that, and I've got some good quotes here, and then we'll get into the dream giants. He says, it's been observed that ceremonies are the most difficult parts of human culture to change, and therefore represent its most ancient elements. The dream, on the other hand, is the freest and most spontaneous, and therefore the newest type of activity which any human being is capable. The coming together of the dream and the ceremonial interpretation is therefore like meeting positive and negative clouds in the sky, which give rise to lightning, and that lightning can turn into the dynamos of human progress, or can blast that individual through him, his society. So he's now saying that he wants to find what he considers primitive peoples that are still doing ancient ceremonies, because that's the most original route that he can get to, and then analyze their dreams, which is the newest part, and hopefully there's some sort of insight here. So when he starts talking to all these different people and having them analyze their dreams, he starts noticing that almost every single one of them have these huge giants in their dreams. Giants that are either there to protect them or that are guarding other things. And now he's starting to realize this actual archetype that's consistent, and which is also somewhat different than anything that he's used to in the Western dream interpretation.
Yeah, I'm reading about these Bontoc people. So, and again, could the giants have been, at this point, they had already come into contact with like settlers and everything, right? So they had,
yeah. That's why he knew certain ones were friendly to Americans specifically.
Because I'm thinking, you know, to them, one of these settlers or something would be a sort of giant. And I'm sure that some helped them, similar to how some caused havoc and blood feuds and incest and all that stuff, right?
This is honestly one of the places where the Mormon background of Riggs Stewart kind of comes into play, because there's also a Mormon aspect of blood feud, where you actually can only save somebody by killing them, because they've become so corrupted that it would be unjust for you not to take them out. And I guess this is one of the biggest places where Riggs Stewart was getting his world rocked, because he's trying to understand this culture that he had bedded himself in. So they're talking about this god that they worship, Talandian, and how if you cause adultery, then the husband is obligated to kill the adulterer. Like if you were to sleep with someone else's wife, that guy, like her husband, would not only have every right to kill you, but it would be mandatory by culture. Like you couldn't not kill him. So he's asking one of these guys back and forth about this, and he asks him, doesn't Talandian get mad when you kill a man for committing adultery? And the pygmy tells him, the Negrito, no, Talandian doesn't mind if you kill people. The guy's name was Juan, by the way, said Juan.
Nice.
He only gets mad if you don't kill them to fulfill the blood feud. If you killed someone in my group, that would not make Talandian angry at you, but he would be mad if one of us did not kill you in return to avenge the death. Letting you live is a violation of the blood feud. I will not get a wife and take her my wife and no longer have a husband. You as a white man wouldn't have to worry in the southern groups if you took a wife, because all Negrito bands all the way were told by this guy. This is like a cargo cult aspect too. You know what a cargo cult is?
Yeah, those are the ones that they don't have any human interaction, right? But they...
Right, or they only have like the smallest limited interaction, and then they attribute that interaction to like the thing that they were doing before. The best example is the gods must be crazy. A plane flies over, they throw a Coke bottle out the window, it hits some dude on the head, and now all of a sudden it's like the most useful tool in the whole... It's a comedy movie. It's like a National Lampoon style movie.
But is it literally like... From the cargo, they create their...
Yeah, it's literally like if they just dropped cargo. Like, cargo cult would be, you drop a load of cargo into an impoverished area, and all they see is resources coming from the sky, and they're like, damn, how do we... What dance do we have to do? What song do we have to sing to have another cargo crate just fall out of the sky? And they start forming religions or cults around it, as if you can pray... the assistance there, as opposed to just, you know, contacting your delegate or sending an email or a tweet or something. But there's an aspect of this, because in this group that he's with, there was a guy that worked for the army that also came in contact with this group and called Lucas. So, and this guy Lucas, he was a Christian, and he explained to everyone when he was there that being a Christian makes you a blood brother with everyone else that's a Christian. Therefore, all Christians are in this same group. So now this is the interesting part. I hope I'm bearing the lead here, but that Rig Stewart embedded in this tribe, he's safe because of this concept of blood feud. The idea is that if he does something, if he were to like have adultery with someone else's wife in that group, then all the other people in that group would be mandated by their god to kill Rig Stewart. But because Rig Stewart was white, and these pygmies, they understood that all white people are Christians and all Christians are blood brothers, that if they were to kill him back, well, now they've got every Christian on the planet that's now going to be coming after them in a blood feud, because they didn't understand that their god blood feud rules weren't the same as Christian blood feud rules. They're just seeing like, damn, dude, their gang is like millions deep and our gang is maybe 30 deep. So Rig Stewart starts getting this idea in his mind, like, I can do anything. Like, these people are afraid of me because they think that I've got every Christian on the planet like standing behind me. And if they do something wrong, then it'll just be nonstop war against them versus all Christians, which is kind of a weird concept. But this was something that kind of kept him safe in this particular community. So this just, and the reason that I'm even harping on this is because it goes to show how embedded in the mind this act of like vengeance and revenge was. It wasn't like, oh man, I hope that guy I wronged doesn't come after me. It's like, if you wrong someone, they will come after you because the god commands that they come after you. Like, it's not even about me angry at you. Now it's about me being afraid of God being angry at me for not rectifying the situation with you.
So you insert this supernatural sort of thing, and he's able to literally be a god amongst the men because he can use his... that like a sort of like neurolinguistic programming, because he was like able to manipulate these people that way he could break the rules and the laws and not suffer the consequences for it.
He honestly does end up not marrying fully, but he takes on like a side chick in the tribe and has relations with her because he's no longer concerned about his safety once he understands this like Christian dynamic. So I think that's pretty interesting. Like, as soon as he's like, oh, I got a cheat code, he's like, I'm going to use that cheat code.
Yeah, which, I mean, there's even people today using that, right? I think that a lot of religion stems a lot from this concept of, right? There's religions, for example, the Jews, that they're able to trick their God and they're able to do things within the parameters because, hey, if there's a string here, that means I can do this, or whatever the ones is that they have a platform on the back of like the forklift, because they're not allowed to operate heavy machinery. But as long as they're doing it from this platform behind it and they have like extensions on the levers of the forklift, then it's okay, right? It's, well, like, what?
I think everyone knew that kid in school that like would agree to something, and then an hour later they'd be like, my shoelaces were crossed, and you're like, dude. Or like, my finger was crossed when I said that. So it's, yeah, it's got the same energy. And I guess technically, if you allow that to happen. So, okay, so here is the first documented account where he sits down and he asks one of these pygmies, one of the people that had been acquainted with Americans, so he can actually communicate with them. And he says, what's the worst dream in your entire life that you can remember? So now he's got this Negrito recounting the scariest dream that he's ever had. And this is where the beginning of these dream giants come from. So this is the recounting in the 40s or 50s on when this guy's talking. He says, a black cloud is chasing me. I've had it many times. Sometimes I was alone, sometimes with a group. The black cloud growled and muttered the voice of thunder. Always I woke up expecting lightning to strike me. And my best dream was that of a man where the body looked like my father but had the head of a horse, light in color, with mane hanging down in front of his face. He had seen Filipinos riding horses along borders of the Negrito territory, and this dream character called a Dwindy picked him up in his dream, soared through the air with him, showing him strange places where game could be found. Later, it visited him while he was awake and had gone off with it alone into the jungle on successful hunts. So now he's saying that he's actually getting a guide that's like, let's go here and find animals, and it's actually working with him, and it's not just while he's asleep. It's like these wake-initiated lucid dreams that he's having. And then let me finish this off because it gets better. To break the spell, his wife had rubbed her naked buttocks all over her husband's body. After that, Dwindy had come no more. Pana had beaten his wife for using magic to scare it away, but his spirit friend never returned. So his wife has a remedy for this. To break the spell, she rubs her naked buttocks all over her husband's body. After that, Dwindy had come no more. But the guy gets mad. He actually ends up beating his wife for using magic to scare it away, but the spirit never came back. So there's this specific form of a magic antidote where your wife basically just rubs her buttocks all over your body.
That sounds good. I think I like that. And you said Dwindy. Is it Duende? Because Duende is...
D-W-I-N-D-I.
D-W-I...
I'm probably mispronouncing it, yeah, because I can't speak the language of elephants natively.
Because a duende is a duende is a humanoid figure of folklore. So it's like a little gnome in Latin American cultures. And by the way, the Ayala Corporation, one of the country's oldest and largest conglomerates, and they're in the Philippines, and they're actually worth billions and billions of dollars. So
this is basically a homunculus corporation, it sounds like, yeah.
And their net income, Paranoid American, is $36 billion as of 2021. So right there, we got the gematria. The numbers are speaking for themselves. So, all right, she rubs her naked ass on him. He gets mad, and then he beats his wife for using ass but magic.
But the magic worked, yeah.
But it worked.
The book does not expand any more on this. I feel like if this were my book, I would have stopped and then documented the whole origin of the rubbing your butt on your husband ceremony, because that seems important enough to spread to the rest of the world. But I guess that'll be lost forever for the pygmies.
It does.
Okay, so let's get to the namesake here, the dream giants, because that's kind of the lead. So he says there was also something familiar about the emerging pattern in this guy Juan Pana's dreams and visions. If I thought hard enough and fast enough about them, the bad storm giant and the good duende seemed to help the fire bring more light into the blackness of a well. The horse-faced duende had made Pana a famous hunter, a leader in his horde. So this is the dream duende guy that's showing him the where to get all these animals. They're having a real impact on his actual life, because now he's sort of the best hunter around, since he always knows where the hell the animals are going to be. But no one knows that he's getting the inside scoop from this do that he has to get rid of by his wife wiping her butt on him. But that it gave him this second sight, and it made him into a prophet who could lead the group to food as Moses led the children out of Israel and Egypt. And here's the Mormon part, and how Joseph Smith had led the Mormons west. So you could see the guy writing this. He's like, oh, you're just like Jesus, and Jesus is just like Joseph Smith. So there's like this direct correlation in his mind.
Of course.
But Panah's white dream giant, which had apparently made him wander around at night in the state of a trance, could not withstand an attack from the social world. His wife's body, her words and gestures had destroyed the dream giant or had locked it out from his consciousness. He could no longer become aware of it. Neither could his black dream giant withstand the attack of the shamans once he had introduced it to them in the trance state. With infinite cunning, they teased, threatened, and cajoled the mysterious inner force into cooperating with them. They made it express itself in words using certain rhythms and groans and sobs, and it told them that their friendly spirits would wage a relentless, never-ending war with it in the dream life until it was destroyed if it did not give up hurting him and become a healing spirit. And with that, Panah awakened and his headache was gone. The presence of the shamans, who had themselves been healed, showed that these cures could be made permanent once a black giant had been tamed or harnessed. So now they're saying that if you encounter these dream giants in your dreams, that you can go to a shaman and almost like summon the giant, almost doing like a regressive, like a, I would say hypnotherapy, right? Like you put him into a state of a trance or hypnosis. And like, okay, we want to talk to the giant now. And the giant comes up, and it says that they sort of cajole him. And so it's like, yo, you ain't nothing. You're shit, you know, stupid dream giant. And eventually it's like, oh, man, all right, you got me. And it stops messing with them. And it either converts into a good dream giant, like a black lodge to a white lodge, or it goes away, or the person now has some sort of like resistance built up to it.
That's really interesting. So as long as you verbally abuse the black dream giant, then you're able to extract some healing property from it in a sort of weird, magical, talismanic way.
In his words, tease, threaten, and cajole. Those are the things that you do to a black dream giant and not a white dream giant. The white dream giant is the good dream giant, I guess.
But if you rub your wife's bare buttocks on your body, then he goes away.
He might be gay, so that's like not his thing. So he's like, I'm out of here. I don't want some chick rubbing her butt all over me.
Wow. Yeah. So that's the dream giant. So they're able to, and did they talk about various people in that tribe using these dream giants to take away their ailments, or was it just that one isolated incident?
No, this is a common thread, and that's why he ends up writing this entire book about dream giants. Wow. It wasn't just the one dude he talked to. It's everyone that he talks to. So he talked to another old shaman, and this old shaman describes that his dream giant is he gets on the back of this huge hornbill, and he flies over mountains covered in cold white stuff. And what he's doing is describing snow and ice. But according to Rig Stewart, talking about the shaman had never experienced snow or ice before. He just knew that there was this cold stuff on top of mountains that was white.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know what to make of that, but it almost seems, again, like these dream giants are showing them around the world and giving them insight into things that they normally wouldn't. 11 Stranger Things, right? Like going and seeing Russian generals like plotting against the U.S. So this is him finally, after he's talking to all these different people and getting all their dreams. It says, as the night progressed, I got the impression that the mind of the Negrito was not as simple as I thought, but formed a mosaic of complications. And in some way, modern civilization might make man's personality more simple and unified than it was among the Negritos. Perhaps this had something to do with Bayer's question of why the Negrito could not exist away from his land or adapt to new situations. This has got a little tinge of racism and maybe lowered expectations there.
But it makes sense, though, right? Because, so he says the modern world oversimplifies man. So we lose touch with these. I've never dreamed of a giant before. I mean, I don't know if you have, but it kind of...
Well, I think he's implying city slickers would also do it. Like, if it's not your wife's naked butt getting rubbed all over you, it's just you another existing form of magic. In society.
Yeah, exactly. That makes
like
them
society go. Is the butt that's wiping itself with you constantly is the way that I'm picking up from that.
Yeah, I mean that's life will spit, you know, chew you up and spit you back out. And I don't know, is the talking elephant after all this, or were the talking elephants the guy that wrote the book before? Do you have anything?
That was
on
the
that?
Guy that wrote the book before, in which Riggs Stewart formed all his initial opinions, and later I don't want to plagiarize is a strong word, but used that guy's writings and what he said as gospel and built on top of it. So the talking with elephants is the original DNA. Like, that's what gave the guy credibility to be like, oh damn, well, if this dude can talk to elephants, then clearly anything he's writing about these people is probably legit, because he's getting some of this information directly from elephants.
Which it plays into the whole elephants have like a long memory type of thing, so they'd be able to tell him all the secrets.
Yeah. They remembered it the longest. Yeah.
Wow. So do you have anything on the talking elephants? Like, what did they tell him? Like, does he write about that?
I didn't read that guy. I didn't read Noon's book. No,
bro,
I didn't
get read into Noon's book.
What did the elephants actually say to Noon? I don't know. It's a good question.
We got, what does the elephant say? Right. What does the fox say? Well, what is the elephant? Cause the elephant is the link, bro. The elephant is the 36. Say? So we're going to have to read this dude's book on the talking elephants. But yeah, no, this is really interesting. I think that reality is a lot more malleable than we've been told, right? If it's only influenced through dreams, you know, that's up for debate. Like, hey, you can only affect reality through the dreams, or, you know, people will say that even thoughts can have an effect on reality. Freaking Paracelsus talked about how men who have bad thoughts or bad ideas, they will manifest themselves as, right, in the movie Homunculus. So all of everyone's deepest, darkest traumas attach themselves as a form of homunculus, this psychological entity. But at the same time, while you're looking at these psychological traumatic entities on people, they're looking back at you. So then in turn, they attach themselves to you. Right. So it's like what's that one saying? When you stare into the abyss will stare right back at you. And it's like, that's to me, like, is that the observer effect? Like, what is that? And the fact that these people were dreaming of places that they'd never been to before, for example, the cold white stuff on the mountains. Like, what is that? Like, how would you be able to explain that? Because they had vocabulary to be able to explain what it was, the concept, but not the name of it. Which the name is just something that you attach to something in order to be able to identify it later on, which again is a product of society. It's the butt, right? It's what's making the magic go away in some sort of talismanic butt.
That, and your wife's butt. Yeah, your wife's butt makes magic go away.
So maybe is that what Crowley was getting at with like the butt stuff? Right? I mean,
well, that's the masculine butt. Yeah, what happens if your husband wipes his butt on a wife?
Does so
that
think
bring
about it.
The dream giants?
Think about it, right? So I know this is like crude and whatever, but the whole point of the butt to Crowley was to enter an altered state of consciousness, right? So when he was being penetrated, it put him in altered states. So there's something to the butt. Bro, there's something magical about the butt, and maybe these people, which tribe was it? The Kanai?
Sonoy was one of them, and then within the Sonoy are all these different specific tribes that he's talking about.
Yeah, they're on to the secrets of the secrets, and it's funny, right? It's funny to say, but a lot of secret societies we kid around, right? You're part of the Masons.
Illuminati confirmed.
But we always kid around about the whole sodomy aspect of it. And it's like, is there something to be said about that in some deeper psychological, how do you say this, archetypical way, right? Like the butt. And then the butt transforms into
I don't know why sodomy always comes up with Masons. It's literally in like one or maybe seven of the degrees. Out of the 33 degrees,
but
only seven
there.
Of them include
Illuminati
sodomy.
Confirmed.
So I don't know why everyone gets so butthurt about it.
But it's there. So
But it, okay, well So there's another dream giant in this book, and this is where the guy starts having a falling out with the rest of the, and I'll paraphrase some of this instead of having to read all of it word for word. But basically, they're gonna have this ceremony. He shacks up with this pygmy chick, right? I don't know how big he is, but he's basically shacking up with, like, she's 3.5 feet tall, I'm assuming. She's like any other pygmy. Yikes. And during this, people are noticing that they're into each other. So, like, oh, you're gonna put a ring on it, right? I mean, not in those words, but they start suggesting having this big ceremony about it. And he's like, okay, yeah, we'll do a ceremony. And he's thinking in the back of his mind too, like, what's she gonna follow me back to the States? Like, she's not gonna be able to get on a plane or on a boat or whatever. So he just kind of playing it out. This is his summer fling with, like, one of the tribal ladies, and he'll just leave her there. Or more importantly, he's going to gift her to somebody, because that's kind of how the culture would have worked. So now he's using her almost as bait, like, hey, treat me nice, tell me about your dreams, and maybe I'll give you this great prize. So he's talking to another person about a dream after they prepared the ceremony. And part of the ceremony is they went out and they cleared parts of the forest so that they could do, you know, these, like, ritual dances and all the things that you would do leading up to a wedding. So after they clear this area, one of the Negritos, he has a dream of an earth demon, dream giant that's an earth demon. And that in this dream, the giant earth demon tells him that he's mad that they cleared this very specific plot of land away. Took him all day. It took, like, a whole bunch of guys, you know, grueling hours during the day to clear all this land. This guy has a dream, and he wakes up the next morning, and he's like, hey, guys, you know that, like, 8 to 10 hours we spent yesterday getting all hot and, like, exerting all of our effort to clear that field? Well, I had a dream, and my dream giant says that he doesn't want us to use that field anymore. So we're going to just ignore all that work from yesterday. We're going to redo it today and clear this new field and do it in this field. And it sounds crazy to the guy that's here to observe. And he's like, but you guys are just going to waste all that time of clearing that field and just be like, oh yeah, well, if the dream giant says we can't use it, then I guess we can't use it. And in this way, and this is where I'll start to paraphrase some of it, but he was just like, let's just use it. Let's just use the field. Like, we already did all the work. Like, come on, what's the worst thing that can happen? So they end up using part of this field, and some horrible things end up happening. They get worse results in some of their crops. And now all of a sudden people are looking at him like, dude, the outsider screwed all this up for us. Like, he's the one. And now he's got to kind of look behind his shoulder a little bit, because he's kind of made himself a target in a way. And then he also realizes that this wife that he kind of had assumed that even prompted this ceremony to happen, now it's almost like this wife is like this gold chain that he's wearing to, like, some pretty, like, rap shows in Miami or something, right? Like, now he's making himself a target for a whole bunch of different reasons. And he starts to be like, eh, maybe it's time I start wrapping this little expedition up and going home. But it all is directly because of these dream giants that are starting to tell them, like, this guy's the problem. Like, he's actually causing all these issues.
Well, it's making me think of, like, how many things, even in political history or any political figures or anything, really, that the founding fathers, right? Because Abraham Lincoln, I mean, he's not a founding father, but he talked about, like, giants roaming the land. And it's just making me think of how many people throughout history have maybe had a run-in with these dream giants telling them to do certain things or not do certain things. It's really interesting to think about. Like, is there any other dream giant analysis aside from these pygmy people that you've seen while doing research into this? Or is it just strictly isolated to these specific peoples?
Well, his book was specific to these type of what they call dream giants. But yeah, if you just do regular dream analysis, but there's also, like, I've done a couple shows with Abby, Abstract One, from Secret Society of Good Guys. And she's got this whole dream hacking thing. I think she also did it with Owen Hunt a little bit. But that one also, if you get into the lucid and the hacking aspect of it, then you can manifest dream giants, or you can kind of, like, explore them. But I don't think it's the same way, because in those cases, you're sort of cognizant of introducing a dream giant. Whereas, where he's describing these pygmy dream giants, this is a constant archetype that they all got. I guess it's up to speculation, though. Maybe one guy had a dream giant story and he tells it around the fire and everyone's like, damn, dude, did you hear Juan's dream giant story? That was dope. And then someone else is like, oh, I had a dream giant story, too. And then all of a sudden everyone's talking about dream giants, right? Because it's like the thing to do. And if you don't have a dream giant, well, what's wrong with you? Why is your wife rubbing her butt all over you while you're asleep? And that's why you can't dream of giants.
Yeah. What are you gay of the dream giants? Right. And like I said, dream giants equals 33.
Illuminati confirmed.
And in Sumerian, it equals 666. So we know that the dream giants are actually the incarnate spirits of the...
They're Nephilim. They kind of would be. And so there's one extra money. This is outside of the dream giants and pygmies, but as this guy is starting to overstay his welcome, he runs into another American, or he might have been a British guy, but he runs into another white dude that's also just like living amongst these natives named McGregor. And McGregor is like a combination of like a sex tourist and an Indiana Jones. Like he's out for exploration, but also
for the pussy.
He realized, like, dude, I can just start running through these tribal pygmy ladies, and it's kind of my thing. Like, he develops a kink for it, and the way that they talk to each other is so casual. Like, they're just two guys at a bar, and he recounts some of this. So this is what he says about McGregor. He says it. I listen with increasing astonishment to McGregor's accounts of experiences during 60 years of adventurous living. He had been on this present venture for 3 months and glad to have someone else to talk to, and his most astounding tales concerned 30-odd native wives from half as many mountain tribes. So he's bouncing the 15 different tribes in the region and just taking up wives to every different tribe, like two wives from each tribe that he goes to, just like checking out all the different car models. And he says that he was an authority on native marriage ceremonies and customs, and observed the laws of courtship and the taboos of all the native groups into which he married. And this is his advice that he gives to Rig Stewart about this debacle that he kind of finds himself in. He said, pick out the one you like, give her old man a deer, sit through some boring ceremonies, and the girl is yours. At first she'll be bashful and sweet, but then when she starts to get grouchy or thinks that she can rule the roost, you simply send her back to her family with another deer and a few silver pesos. This gives her enough wealth to ensure marriage to a younger man and everyone is happy. The old native leaders really like it. They think marriage to a white man, even for a short time, brings new mana into the tribe. For we whites are supposed to have stronger spirits. You think they'd raised racehorses and knew the dangers of too much inbreeding. So now he's like just jumping around like, bro, you can just marry him, hang out for a couple months, and then once you lose interest, send him back home with like, here's an extra $20, you know, take care of yourself and move on to the next. And he's like, dude, I've done this like 30 times now. This is the life. So I don't know, I thought that was interesting that the book starts with him being all like, I want to discover the native, you know, peoples, and I want to psychoanalyze their dreams. And as you read it, it turns into like, uh-oh, what did I get myself into? And then this other guy's like, bro, here's how you get out of it. You send her back home with some money and a deer.
Yikes. That's the way of hacking the Matrix, that you wipe the slate clean and move on to the next one. So listen, dude, if for those listening, I haven't been plugging the voicemail a lot, but I want to collect voicemails, and maybe Thomas and I can get back together and talk about it. But if you've ever had a dream with a giant or anything in it, or whatever, right? So we're looking for giant dreams with giants. Call in 407-476-4606 and let us know about your dream with the giants and what the giant told you, if he was angry or what. And then if you've ever had your wife's bare ass rubbed on you, also call and let us know. 407-476-4606. And I want to start doing a couple shows on the voicemails again. I haven't really been plugging it all that much, but here we are. Dude, Thomas, this is really interesting. We should read the Talking Elephants book and come back and talk about that some more.
And let me just slip in as quick as I can. There's the last thing that he talks about in this book is when he's with McGregor, he noticed all these women that are like he's staying with, and he's like, damn, you got a lot of women around here, but it's also been really quiet. Like, what? Like, how come I haven't heard them talking or any chatter? And he tells them, like, oh no, there's this other dope part why I like these pygmies so much, is that they've got a specific thing they wear called a golden muzzle. So they, like, actually wear this, like, it's a decoration piece that they use to show their ranking, but also it's a literal gold muzzle that fits over their mouth so that they can't make any noise. And he's basically telling him, he's like, dude, this is so great. Like, they're convinced that this was, like, a nice necklace that I bought them and that they're all dressed up, but it, like, also they can't talk while they're wearing it. Yeah. This jewelry was designed for them to not be able to speak. So it's and he's pretty jazzed about that. I think he tries to take it back to America, but it doesn't catch on.
Yeah, obviously not. Dude, plug your stuff so we can get out of here. And
ParanoidAmerican.com, IlluminatiComic.com, and also the things that's been blown up the most lately are conspiracycards.com, which are a whole bunch of sort of parody conspiracy cryptids, legends. We got Alex Jones and Bill Hicks and Dr. Ewan Cameron and all kinds of MK Ultra and cult leaders and stuff that I've repurposed into my favorite baseball cards of all time, mid-80s, early 90s, Donruss, Fleer, Topps, Upper Deck inspired designs that I recreated. So everyone seems to like them as much as I like them, so I'm going to keep working on those for years to come.
Awesome. Check those out. TJOJP.com, Patreon.com/The11Podcast, Twitch.tv/The11Podcast. All that good stuff. Make sure to call in 407-476-4606. Tell us about your dream Giants, and we'll play it on the next Talking Elephants episode that Thomas and I can, we'll get together and do. So appreciate you guys being here. Thomas, thank you for being here, bro. And as always, everyone, catch you on the other side, and be careful with the Dream Giants. May.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.